Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung Earthlets, and welcome to another episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am Molchar, the publicity driver for 2000 AD, and we have another thrill-packed edition of the official 2000 AD podcast for you this week. We not only have two special guests, one of our longest-serving script droids, Ian Edgington, who's on to talk about his new series coming up next month in 2000 AD, but we also have one of our newest creators, Daniel Dyer, who's on to talk about his first Future Shock for 2000 AD, which is out in this week's edition. Talking of which, Prog 1932 is out today, available from all good film merchants and digitally from the 2000 AD web shop and DRM-free apps. In it, you've got a fantastic lineup. John Wagner on both Judge Dredd and Strontium Dog. You've got Pat Mills and Simon Davis on Slain. That continues to be an absolute feast for the eyes. Second episode of Eddie Robson and Mike Collins' Tharg's thriller, Commercial Break, which is turning into a very interesting story, and A Future Shock by Daniel Dyer, along with Dan Lester and David Bailey, which we'll be talking to Daniel in a bit. For those of you who want to get up close and personal with 2000 AD, this coming weekend we are at two conventions, both of them in the north of England. The first is Wonderlands, which is taking place at Sunderland University. Now, this is a graphic novel convention that has been set up by veteran 2000 AD artist Brian Talbot, and the point of it is to celebrate graphic novels in all their forms, whether it's original graphic novels, whether it's collections, and just to give a focus to this particular art form within comics. And we'll have two fantastic guests there that this coming weekend, which is Ian Edgington, who we'll be speaking to later, and also his co-creator of Brass Son, which is Ian Culbard. They'll both be there along with myself and our publishing droid B3N. We will also be at Film and Comic Con Manchester, which is taking place at Event City, right next door to the Trafford Centre in Manchester, and graphics novel editor Robo Keef will be there with a table full of the latest graphic novel releases and also 2000 AD merchandise. So if you're going to either of those conventions, please do come by and say hello. Now, let's face it, we've all dreamt of it. We've all dreamt of either drawing or writing for 2000 AD as loyal readers. Very few have got to do it over the years, but when you do, then the opportunity is available to you as a minion of Tharg the Mighty are endless. The submissions process for 2000 AD is actually closed at the moment just because of the sheer number of submissions that we've had over the last 6 months. So thank you to everyone who has tried their hand. Submissions will reopen in September. So if you go to 2000adonline.com/submissions, then you'll be able to see all the guidelines, both for writers and artists. So get those pencils sharpened and those computers, word processors, laptops, etc., raring to go for when submissions open in September. One of the other ways in which you can pitch to 2000 AD, if you're an artist, is to go to the Thought Bubble convention in Leeds every November, where the 2000 AD portfolio competition takes place. Now, young hopefuls come along with a sample script that they have drawn, which is provided by 2000 AD and the convention, and they are then chosen by either Tharg himself or some of his art droids to go forward to a panel discussion where each page by the first page by each prospective artist is put up on a big screen and judged by some of our top artists. Now, this can be a nerve-wracking experience. It's pretty unique amongst British comics to go through this process. But the winner, because it's so worth it, the winner gets a paid gig at 2000 AD. And so many great artists have got their big break in the industry by getting their first Future Shock. So it's a remarkable opportunity from the galaxy's greatest comic. And last year's winner was Daniel Dyer, as I mentioned, who came all the way from Dusseldorf to take part in the convention. So joining us on Skype all the way from Dusseldorf in Germany is Daniel Dyer. Welcome to the 2080 Thrillcast, Daniel.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So, Daniel, you're getting your first work published in 2080 after winning the 2080 Portfolio Competition at Thought Bubble last November.
Yes.
Why did you decide to come all the way over from Dusseldorf and enter the competition in Leeds?
I wanted to work for 2080 beforehand, before I knew about Thought Bubble and the competition, but my submission got rejected.
Oh,
and Matt Smith, he gave me some advice, some two lines in the rejection letter, and I was on the online site of 2000 AD, and there was this banner for the Thought Bubble competition, and I just wanted to go over the submission guidelines again. And I thought this would be a good opportunity, a second opportunity, to see whether I can improve, and to get a more personal approach to things, to meet people face to face, and to see if it works.
Yeah. Okay. did you come over on your own, or did you come over with friends?
My girlfriend was with me, but she wasn't in the audience. Because I said I would be too nervous if she was there too.
Well, how did you feel when your art was chosen to appear before the panel?
It was fantastic. It was already a victory.
Mm-hmm.
I was my portfolio got reviewed by John Davis Hunt on the day before the panel, and he was impressed, gave me a little bit of good advice, and I thought this already is good. This to be chosen among the few chosen ones was terrific, and I thought even if I don't get even if I don't win, it's perfect already. Yeah,
excellent. Yeah. Well, with the panel, I force the chosen ones to stand in front of the audience as their work is being analysed by the panel. What was it like standing up there in front of that audience?
I was nervous, like now, but but it was good, because it indicated that it meant something to me, so it wasn't a bad thing. It was being nervous somehow, but on at the same time relaxed, because as I said, it was already a victory being chosen.
Yeah. And did the panel give you any advice?
There was first, I was quite impressed, because everyone was thought good of my portfolio, and there were a discussion started, and the themes, the aspects were the different types of making good comic. It was about a good panel layout, to make good compositions, balancing out black and white contrasts in a black and white drawing, how the reader's eye is guided by your panels, and this all was discussed along my drawings, and it was terrific to hear the artist talk about that alongside my art.
Okay, and I mean, how did you feel when we announced that you were the winner?
I was speechless. And
good.
Was very happy, and then I got a little paranoid.
Right.
Because it went too well. I thought, oh, maybe the plane's gonna crash on my way back to Düsseldorf. Because yes, it's I didn't expect something like that at all.
Yeah. And did it take a long while for the news to sink in that you'd won and you were going to get a paid job at 2008A?
Yes, it took the whole afternoon, and then I went back to some of the artists who were at the panel, to John McRae, and I went to Matt Disraeli to tell him about it, because I spoke to him beforehand, before the panel started. And Dave Taylor I talked to, and then after they congratulated me again after the panel, it slowly sank in. Yes, and that was great. Yeah.
Well, let's fast forward sort of 6 months, and the story that's going to be that is appearing in this week's 2000 AD. Tell us a bit about the story that you've drawn.
The story is somehow it's a futuristic story, but at the same time it's somehow a 70s bank robbery story.
Right.
And it's a intergalactic bank robbery, and there are three guys who want to make fast money, and they get the information that a money transport spacecraft is transporting the currency between planets in a system. One of the last two is dealing with physical currency.
Yeah,
and they want to make a hit and run mission out of it and smash this spacecraft and run away with the money. And they get more money than they can stomach. Their characters aren't stable enough to handle with what they are finding.
Right.
But I would spoil the ending if I talk too much. Yeah.
Fair enough. When you were drawing this story, were you nervous? I mean, I've heard stories about people who've got their first Future Shock at 2000 AD and have redrawn it again and again and again and again.
Yes.
how was the process of actually drawing this this strip?
It was when I drew the Future Shock for the portfolio competition. That was the time when I redraw again and again.
Right.
This time I was a little bit more confident, but at the same time I only had 4 pages to show what I would be capable of. It was a little bit of pressure, but I tried to balance it, because if it's if I'm too I'm missing the words, too
unrestricted sort of.
Yes.
Yeah.
It would at the worst case it would come out in my drawings as well, and this was something I didn't want. I want to have it a little more easygoing, because it's a nice little story about bank robbers, and not something that that should be restricted, because you ought to have fun with it.
Yeah.
And I try to translate this feeling into the story. Yeah, but as I said, it's my first publication, and 4 pages to show, here I am, that's what I have to offer, and
Right. How did you get into drawing in the first place? Is it something you've always done?
Yes, always. Even before I can remember, I'm drawing. I draw it in kindergarten. It was a muscular man fighting cats, big giant cats. And,
brilliant.
And I was flipping through my mom's Popeye comics. Mm-hmm. I couldn't read them, but yes, they were my first comic influences. And he was smashing up people or creatures all the time. So I took this over to my drawings. Mm-hmm. And later came Ninja Turtles, which was somehow a relief because you hadn't to draw human beings. It was easier. yes, but it was all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are your comic book influences? I mean, I don't know much about the German comic book scene. Is it mostly sort of American and British imports, or do you have like a homegrown industry?
There is a little homegrown industry, but it's very small. It's a nice, friendly community, but nothing like the British, American, or French, for example.
Oh yes, of course.
Yes, Paris is only a few hours away, but it's another planet. And I grew up in a small town called Mülheim an der Ruhr, and there were no comic book stores.
Yeah,
there was only a newsstand where I got just Batman, Superman, and Spider-Man throughout my whole teenage years, and it was quite a diet.
Yeah.
But when I was around 16, I went to the town's library, and somehow I don't know why they had Judge Dredd America.
Oh right! Wow! Yes. What a starting point.
It was a great starting point and it was something who showed me what comics could be capable of. It wasn't the typical scenario where the good guy would save the day and end all the story. It was quite the contrary. And before that, I just saw the Sloan movie and read a few Dredd Batman crossovers, but it wasn't something nearly as exciting as this story. And from there on, I was addicted to the anti-hero concept. So it started out with Judge Dredd America, and there were the 80s Frank Miller Batman Daredevil stories, Lone Wolf and Cub, and later then came Button Man.
Yes, yeah. Brilliant John Wagner, Arthur Ransom crime story, yeah.
Yes, and this was really terrific. Arthur Ransom, I don't have to say anything about him because he's genius and... these are my main comic book influences. And in case of Arthur Ransom, also influence in my art. I didn't know how he managed this because he isn't as cross-hatching all the time.
Yeah.
When you look at his faces, he has a lot of empty space, but then again, he's defining very much with the lines he's doing, but still today it's somehow mysterious to me how he's managing to make his art. And I was quite sad to hear about him in your Thrillcast when you talked to Alan Grant that he wasn't drawing anymore.
I would quite happily see Arthur Ransom draw forever, to be honest. He's one of my favorites. So was it this exposure to 2000 AD and Judge Dredd and into the anti-heroes, was that like a defining moment in your artwork? All of a sudden it kind of opened up all this new world to you.
Yes, it opened up a lot, but it was still difficult to get these stories in in my teenage years, and I would try to get those Judge Dredd stories. I didn't know about 2000 AD then. I just thought, well, it's a Judge Dredd comic, and yeah, and in my later teenage years and around my early 20s, I somehow stopped reading or collecting comics. I don't know exactly why, but yes, I would come back later to Judge Dredd again after I saw the 2012 Dredd movie, which was and is, in my opinion, the best comic book adaptation.
Absolutely.
Just because for being not a epic story, but just for Dredd, it was Wednesday. It was 2000 AD Prague, and I think he wouldn't remember next week after the story what happened there.
Yeah. absolutely. So as a new artist. Now, our submissions process is currently closed until September, but I know that there are a lot of artists who are chomping at the bit to show their wares to Tharg once it reopens. As our newest artist appearing in our pages, what would be your advice to wannabe 2000 AD artists?
My advice, it's difficult to say something because I only took advice.
Well, what was the best advice that you received when you were looking to draw for 2000 AD?
What was the best advice? I think it's somehow banal, but keep on drawing, keep on practicing. Visit comic cons. Thought Bubble was my first one, but it was some of the best things in my life,
right,
to meet the artists, the writers, and be in a chat with them. But I'm thinking right now of something intelligent to say.
No, that sounds like pretty solid advice, really. Just kind of keep plugging away, and I guess whenever you get advice from people in the know, then follow it, I guess.
Yes, and don't shy away from the things which aren't as easy for you. For example, you notice, when I am drawing foots, feet, I have a few problems, or I'm slowing down always when it comes to feet. Then maybe you should take a weekend just drawing feet, not all the time, but make a seminar of it.
There is one very, very prominent and shall remain nameless American artist who's done very well in his career, able to draw feet.
I know who he is. And actually, now I remember why I'm mentioning feet. I was standing in the queue before John McRae's table, and there was a girl where John was reviewing her portfolio and noticed, look here, your feet are a little bit off.
Right.
And he went in with his pen and made some corrections.
Right.
For her, and yes, I think that's how it works.
Right. Brilliant. One thing it would be remiss of me to ask about is when you came up onto the stage at Thought Bubble. When I saw your name, I made a bit of an unfair joke, which I think left you a little nonplussed about your name. Do you know who Danny Dyer is?
Yes, yeah. I didn't felt that it was unfair. I just noticed, oh, here's some joke for the British. I have to look it up. And then I saw some clips on YouTube and thought, oh, well, I think there's nothing. There isn't something like bad publicity.
Brilliant. That is very true.
Yes.
Brilliant. So that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for talking to us, Daniel, and all the best for the future.
Thank you, Mike, and thanks for the kind invitation and to having me on your Thrillcast.
So you've been sending in your feedback to the Thrillcast. Thank you very much indeed for everybody who has tweeted and also emailed. If you want to email us, we're at thrillcast, all one word, at 2000adonline.com. The first bit of feedback is from George White. Thank you very much for emailing in, George. With his feedback. We were talking last time with Johnny Vegas and Dirt Mags about 2080 movies and who would play what. And George says, always thought that David Warner would be a fantastic Torquemada if they ever did a Nemesis the Warlock film. Hayley Steinfeld from that new True Grit would be a good Halo. That's a very interesting call. As would Chloe Moretz from Hit Girl. I'd like the podcast to have a conversation on films that may have borrowed ideas, characters, whatever, from 2000 AD. Obviously, Robocop and Hardware are probably the most notable. There are many films that are perhaps unconsciously bottle that spirit of 2000 AD. The Blood Rain video games are essentially Durham Red. The video game and the awful film spin-off, Ball Count. I've not heard of that, but I'll check it out. There have also been dozens of Rogue Trooper knockoffs, and many of them had a plotline about clone army ninjas or some sort of... I'm not going to read that word out. There was also a British horror film in the 1980s, Extro, that always felt like a future shock to me. Boy watches dad kidnapped by aliens. Spoilers, everybody. Boy watches kidnapped by aliens. 2 years later, dad comes back via instant rebirth through pregnant lady in forest, meets up with son, gives him magic space powers, including summoning a dwarf clown, scaring Lou Beale off EastEnders as nosy old biddy next door, and turning his action man into a human-sized plastic killing machine. I shall be immediately renting Extro if I can find a copy. That sounds like absolutely insane movie making. He also mentions that Attack the Block was reminiscent of Cradle Grave. In many ways. There was the Tom Selleck film Runaway, which was essentially Robo Hunter. Pacific Rim was a bit Detonator X, wasn't it? And Robot Jocks, a bit Millsy, US robot on Soviet robot melee movie set in a Millsy, Pat Mills, post-nuke poverty-stricken underclass dystopia. Those are all very good suggestions. If you have suggestions about films that have ripped off or you feel have ripped off 2000 AD stories, then please do get in touch. Thank you very much to George for his suggestions. We've also been asking for your accounts of your first ever 2000 AD. We've had a couple of emails. I'll read the short one out first, which is from Luke. And he says, my first regular issue of 2000 AD was Prog 458, the one with the Don't Bug Me Creep Judge Dredd by Robin Smith on the cover, featuring the secret diary of Adrian Cockroach, of course, a classic story. I bought it on a school skiing trip to France, kept it. It travelled across the channel with me, there and back, and I still got it. Classic Cam Kennedy drawn Dredd, Halo Jones, Slane, Strontium Dog and Ace Trucking, classic lineup. I tried it once before that, but then found a regular supplier. I've since gone back and picked up all the others and have read the prog ever since, even through the 90s. Well, thank you very much, Luke Williams from Llanelli. That's a fantastic commitment to Thrill Power, carting issues all over the continent. Thank you also to Charles Daniels, who got in touch to say, thought I mentioned my personal history with 2080. Bear with me. It stops and starts for ages. I'm originally from California, but between the ages of 8 and 11, I was very lucky to accompany my uncle Tony on trips back to visit his mother, who lived in Coventry. Now, I may be the only person on earth with warm, glowing memories of childhood holidays to Coventry, but it all seemed very exotic at the time. My uncle had convinced my mother that going to the UK would broaden my horizon to be educational. I get the feeling that this story is going to prove that exactly right. I think he just wanted some company for the long plane journey. Because when we got there, my experience of seeing him was largely being dumped off at his mum's while he went on extended drinking sessions with his old mates. During this time, I stayed in his old bedroom and was left there with stacks and stacks of 2000 AD. I picked up Prog 136 from the stack because it was published on my second birthday and therefore caught my eye. I was only 6 or so years old at that point, but it seemed like digging up some piece of ancient history, and it was from the 70s. I was very taken with the surreal Palais de Boing, and I worked my way through various issues. Seeing my interest, my great aunt dug me up another batch from the comic store, including Prog 335, The Graveyard Shift, and from that story I was hooked. The Graveyard Shift still remains one of my all-time favourite strips of anything ever. Just so fun. Back in California in the late 80s and through the 90s, access to 2000 AD was tricky, but I still picked up issues now and again. In 2004, I moved to Oxford and promptly forgot all about 2000 AD ever existing. How ironic, because we 2000 AD had only just recently moved to Oxford, of course. Until one day at the newsagent, I saw the lovely cover to Prog 1889, looked at it and thought, well, that's probably horrible rubbish nowadays, and what the hell, one old spin down memory lane, and got totally hooked by Thrill Power. Amazed that it's as good as it ever was. How often does that happen? Never. Have been reading the complete case files like a demon, subscribed to the Judge Dredd Mega Collection, and been showing up like clockwork every Tuesday afternoon at Martin's newsagents on Botley Road to get my next hit of Strontium Dog, Grey Area, Orlok, Slain, Dredd, Survival Geeks, Future Shocks, etc. Any one of these titles would justify buying a comic. Having all these is just an embarrassment of riches. Well, thank you so much for your comments, Charles. We really appreciate that. It's great to know that you've not only got a long history with 2000 AD, but that you've come back and found it just as good as ever. If you have a favoured memory of your first 2000 AD, then please do email us at thrillcast, all one word, at 2000adonline.com. We're joining us on Skype from a city that in one 2000 AD world is a smoking crater, and in another 2000 AD world is full of gleaming spires and dark satanic mills. Birmingham is Mr. Ian Edgington. Welcome to the Thrillcast, Ian.
Hi. Welcome from the smoking. Hello from the smoking crater.
I always thought that was the best opening of any strip ever is on Invasion, where it just begins with, you know, Birmingham disappears into a nuclear cloud. I think it's it's a hell of a start. But anyway, thank you for coming on the Thrillcast. You've got a new series coming up, so I thought we'd get you on to talk about it. Because it's your first new series for us in a while, yep. And that is Helium. Do you want to tell us just a bit about the background of Helium?
It's an idea Matt and I, Matt Brooker, Mr. Disraeli, and I've thrown it around for a while, and Nazir Richardson kind of idea, because that tends to be our forte. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of a simple idea of so many hundred years after the Great War. We don't know if it's a World War One Great War or another Great War. And the Earth is engulfed in what's called the Poison Belt, which is a toxic cloud of chemical weapons and biological weapons that have kind of mutated and bred. And because they're heavier than air, they hang lower on the ground. So cities and everything below a certain height is dead. Mm. Nothing can exist below it. And so centuries later, life exists in the highlands, mountaintops, alpine valleys, anything above a certain height. And of course, all trade and transit is done in, you know, airships and balloons. So it caters to a very kind of steampunk visual, you know, big airships and goodness knows what. There's the premise that basically something is harpooning some of these big airship liners and dragging them down beneath the poison belt. So where it was thought that there was no life, there clearly is life, and it's kind of predatory. And so that's kind of our opening. And so it's kind of, well, you know, what's going on, and the mystery kind of unravels from there. It's a great set, because we decided we weren't going to say what time period it was particularly. It could be that world's 1940s, or it could be the distant future, or it could. So there's like, we use modern day terms and anachronistic words and some slang that we've made up, so you're never quite sure what's what.
Yeah,
it's just to kind of make it. It's a melange of like stuff, and we're just throwing things in there and having fun with it.
Okay. And who's the central character? Who is the person that we're rooting for?
She's a police constable in this little village, and her name is called Foundling Hodge, because basically she was found on the beach the slope that goes down into the poison mill as a baby.
Mm.
But what differentiates her from everybody else is that she has pale skin, lavender eyes, and bright green hair. So she's definitely like an outsider. And she was taken in by the police constable, and he and his wife raised her, and she became the constable next herself. And she's got her deputy. It's this guy called Solis Grimsby. He's a great big cyborg in a stovepipe hat, and they make a really good couple. She's quite amoral. She kind of like turned because she knows, you know, there's a lot of black market fuels her town as well. So she turns an eye to a certain amount of illegality because she knows it keeps people fed and, you know, food on the table and things.
Yeah.
But out and out villain. She feels the collar, but she kind of like turns a blind eye to a little bit of criminality.
Right. I'm getting a real kind of time machine feel to this, the kind of Morlocks and the Eloy.
Yeah, because we've got because there is a race. We do discover that there is a race that lives under the poison belt, but I don't want to give too much away.
And so
it suddenly starts to open our world up, and we find that as much as there are survivors living on the mountaintops, there's also other people who live in kind of these hermetic cities and domes underneath as well.
Right.
So each thinks the other is the enemy, but they don't realise there's a third and fourth force milling around as well. So it gets a bit kind of like complicated. You know, the bad guys aren't exactly who you think are the bad guys, and neither are the good guys.
Well, you're very well known for Brass Sun, which is the series that you've been doing with Ian Colbard for 2080 for a few years now, and that's got a lot of different worlds and races and you know, bad guys who aren't necessarily bad guys and good guys who aren't necessarily good guys. It seems like you kind of create these worlds and then you have a lot of fun running around in them and causing a lot of chaos.
Yeah, it's that kind of, it's like building a den when you're a kid and playing cowboys. And it is great fun to do. It's kind of I like world building. I like kind of it's the megalomaniac in me that I like to build these worlds and then crush them.
Yeah.
So it's and also I kind of like to explore grey areas in characters. It's kind of, you know, when you're doing history at school, you know, you find that, you know, Churchill was a hero, Duke of Wellington was a hero, but then as you're older and you delve into it more, you find they did a lot of questionable things, maybe for the right reasons, but you know, they did, you know, a lot of famous people have a lot of red on their hands, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so it's that amorality. It's kind of, you know, what would you, how far would you go to protect the people that you love or do your duty? You know, would you really go back in time and kill, you know, a Hitler as a child? Would you do that?
Yeah.
Could you murder? So it's that kind of these kind of people in very kind of grey areas. In the series I did, Scarlet Traces, the sequel to War of the Worlds, people got quite cross because at the end of the main series, one of the characters actually failed in what they achieved. Everybody thought they should be doing and save the day, and they go, you can't end it there. But it's like, well, that's what happens in life when you're faced with overwhelming odds. Sometimes you just get crushed and,
yeah,
you know, ridden roughshod over. So it's I like to kind of like give that hint of a bit of realism, and when people do kind of question, you know, are they doing the right thing for the right reason, or do they have some other kind of motive? So it adds a lot of interesting colour, I think.
Yeah. Well, I always think of John Wyndham when I read your work, that kind of very English apocalypse kind of thing where, you know, it's ordinary people thrown into extraordinary circumstances, but sometimes the odds are overwhelming and they're not necessarily going to have a happy ending.
Pipe and slippers gothic, I think somebody said.
Brilliant.
I know somebody said the Wyndham, it was like cozy catastrophe.
Yeah.
I like pipe and slippers gothic. There is that. It's kind of it's you know, the things end the way you don't think they're going to end. It's a not a satisfactory ending, but it's an ending, and so yeah. It's. John Wyndham and Nigel Neal especially are big influences on kind of what I do. Mm-hmm. They kind of colour stuff, you know, even indirectly. When I was growing up, I had glandular fever and was quite ill for a good few months. Couldn't go to school. You know, it was the 70s. There wasn't much on TV, so I just read. I just absorbed, you know, Wells and Doyle and John Wyndham, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been it's informed my work. It's become part of my like a genetic bedrock as a writer. So
And where did the idea for Helium come from? Or was it something that you kind of batted back and forth between you and Matt?
It was just that kind of, it just comes as visuals, basically kind of like a smog-covered planet. Mm. And also taking from the Arthur Conan Doyle story, The Poison Belt, you know, the Professor Challenger story.
Yeah.
So, you know, so basically the world's submerged in toxins, everybody lives in the air. And then, so what happened? Well, maybe there is something alive under there and it's pulling things down. Oh, okay. And then the ball kind of starts rolling from there. Well, what happened? Why is it pulling it down? How do they know? So, you know, is there a survivor from one of the ships? And so it all kind of like starts to, you know, one step leads to another. And then I bring Matt in and say, you know, what do you think of this? And he goes, oh, okay, well, how about this or how about that? And,
yeah.
And they come out with some brilliant left of field ideas. Or the thing I really like in this one is then we've got lots of chunky jumpers in this.
Well, if ever there was an advertisement for a series, that's straight in, isn't it?
Lots of chunky jumpers. Because I said, you know, because they're living on the high ground, it's going to be cold, so they're wrapped up against it. So he's done this brilliant line of kind of like semi-Scandinavian knitwear. So that's a good line for Rebellion to do next. And it's great because I just love those. But I keep on saying to him, though, it's going to be a pain because he has to remember all the patterns on the bloody jumpers. But yeah, so it's sci-fi knitwear. That's our next line.
Right, okay. Knit your own 2000 AD. That's clearly going to be a winner. We put a teaser image into 2000 AD a little while ago about Helium, and people immediately drew comparisons with Leviathan, which is another series that you and Matt worked on about a city-sized ship that goes missing. And there's much chatter on our 2000 AD forum over the years about the Edgington verse and how a lot of your work all connects into each other. Is there any connection between this and any of your other worlds?
There wasn't until I kind of like said to Matt, I said, you know, this would fit nicely with and he went, oh yeah, okay. So yes,
right. Okay,
it does.
Right,
it connects with a series that's already run in 2000 AD.
Okay,
there will be allusions. You'll find out that we've got to do more to the other series that will bring it closer to this series.
Right.
I just kind of like the ideas. It's very much for me like the Michael Moorcock books where. Mm. He wrote a lot of like, you know, the novels and things separately, and then put links all up. You know, a character had a similar name in one book to in another, and I kind of like doing that. I thought, well, you know, we'll call the ship that's in Red Sea is the same name as the ship that the pilot has in Helium, and it's this little connection. And I did establish in Red Sea that there's kind of there's 13 worlds that are all kind of linked by this library.
You're right.
And there's the librarian from each world that represents each world. And the 13th world is broken. It's a sundered world. They've had to bar the gates because something happened there. And so that kind of links into things like Amplitude Crucis and a bit into Leviathan, into Red Seas and things. So that's the little like tentative hub that a lot of the stories are kind of hung on.
Mm-hmm.
And I did at some point want to kind of like come up with a character who could actually traverse all the worlds. So you would have him in, you know, the Red Seas world, or you'd have him crop up in Amplitude Crucis, or you'd have him crop up in, you know, Leviathan or Helium or something.
Yeah.
And then that's still like on the back burner, just see how we go. But you're concentrating on this at the minute. Leviathan was a case of a real shame. We kind of shot ourselves in the foot because we kind of did it as a finite thing. And then we actually realised afterwards we should have left it slightly more open because people really liked it and we kind of painted ourselves into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got some ideas about what we can do next with it. So it's kind of watch this space. There is, we do have some ideas to kind of feature Leviathan again and do something with it, but we've got to get this out of the way first. I know Matt's got something else to do, but it's definitely there. There's the maybe something else later on. It all depends what Tharg thinks.
we've talked about Matt sort of slightly obliquely all the way through this conversation, but really, you know, Matt Brooker Disraeli's artwork is just, I think it's some of the most wonderfully inventive artwork that 2000 AD has ever run. You know, a series like Leviathan, he also works on Judge Dredd and things like Low Life.
Yeah.
What is it about your working relationship with Matt that just produces all these wonderfully inventive worlds and series?
I've known Matt longer than I've been married.
Oh, he's your other wife. Okay, right.
Fair enough. And we're like kind of supremely comfortable with each other's in each other's company, and kind of so we have a similar kind of sensibility.
Yeah.
It's kind of very much kind of like I don't know, kind of an Alan Bennett kind of gothic kind of thing. It's crumpets toasted on a bloody fork. So we're both kind of live inside each other's heads anyway. We kind of get where the other is at. And I say, you know, whether I've come up with a story or not, as soon as Matt starts it, it's 50% his, because his input is phenomenal. Mm. It's kind of, I will do a little line saying, oh, I've just written a panel where it's an aeroplane's flying through it like a Miyazaki sky. It's very blue, big white clouds. And I just know he's going to knock that single panel will be knocked out the park, because you know it's Matt, and yeah. He just loves, you know, he loves the detail. Although in Stickleback he has cursed me, because I've kind of put quite a lot of things in, and I there's a lot of like references to various things and characters. I go, and this looks like that, and this looks like that Doctor Who villain, and he'll kind of like go, oh, for God's sake. So it's getting back to joke now. I know I said I don't mind, but so Helium, really, we have a few references, but it's pretty much its own animal kind of thing. It's because we don't know exactly the time scale that it's set in. I don't want to kind of tie it down by saying, oh, well, that character was in a Jules Verne novel or whatever. So it is its own thing. But no, he's a phenomenal artist. He's vastly, I'm not saying underrated, because the people who know him, you know, would have him bronzed. You know what I mean? he should be out there, you know, kind of like, not necessarily with the Mobiuses, but he should be hugely more recognised than he is, because he's a phenomenal talent, and people in the business, you know him. I mean, I showed Jeff Darrow the Scarlet Tracy books a few years ago, and I met him again, and we got talking, and he loved Matt's stuff, you know, and he's an artist's artist, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's a little gem. He really is. So basically, I kind of I fist fight with Rob Williams to keep outside pistols at dawn, Mr. Williams.
Brilliant. Cool. Of course, you and Matt worked together on and not just Scarlet Traces, but also the sequel, the Great Game, where mankind invaded Mars in retaliation, and also you adapted H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds. And there might be a little bit of news on that in the future.
Yes, a nugget of very exciting news. So I can't say no more. But yes, we are cock-a-hoop.
Right, excellent. So thanks very much for coming on to the Thrillcast to talk to us about Helium, and watch out for Volgans, Ian.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
So thank you to Ian and to Daniel for taking the time to talk to us for this Thrillcast. I hope you've enjoyed another fortnightly blast of Thrill Power Earthlit. If you've got any feedback, want to contribute to my first prog, please email thrillcast, all one word, at 2000adonline.com. Please do join us in a fortnight's time on the 2080 Thrillcast, where we're going to be focusing on the Judge Dredd magazine issue 361, which is coming out in June and will be the perfect jumping on issue for the Judge Dredd magazine, with a whole roster of fantastic new stories starting, including a brand new series written by Liam Moore and John Repian, who wrote Black Shuck for 2080, and drawn by a previous winner of the 2080 portfolio competition at Thought Bubble, Mr. Tom Foster. So we're going to be talking to some of the creators behind that issue to get the skinny on why you should start reading the Judge Dredd magazine from issue 361. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2080 is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2080 is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2080online.com, or you can download the free 2080 app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month, with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that are graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000 AD. Make sure you stay Zarjaz, Earthlitz. Splundig Verthrig.